All who have ever had contact with children, whether in their home or in school or wherever, have known that children have a way of wearying you, and the way is by asking you question after question after question after question. And those that are wise have often said to us when we've been weary, leave them alone. It's in asking questions that they come to learn. And how else are they going to know the answer to certain things if they don't ask questions? You know, I feel that it is right that the Christian, in one sense, should live his life or her life in that way, asking questions. What kind of questions should they ask? Well, they are many, of course, and they are varied. For example, the Christian should always be asking the question, how are we to live this Christian life in this world at this particular hour? It isn't a question you can just ask once and answer once and fear that you'll never need to address such a question again. And likewise, the church should always be asking the question, well, how should we really go about serving God where he's put us in the generation of which we are part? Again, it isn't a question that you can just ask once and answer and feel that you've dealt with it and never need to address it again. Now, when you come to this 31st chapter, and when you look at what is happening again in the life of David in this particular situation in which he finds himself, you find that there are issues here that really cause us to address those very matters. There's many allusions and there's much instruction to take on board and to consider when we think of these issues that we must all be concerned about if we are Christians. Now, David's experience at this particular time is an interesting and quite a fascinating one. And it's interesting because it makes us consider, again, the providences of God. This subject that is always uppermost for the Christian and for the church, because it really makes us realize that God is the God of history. God is the God of the generations. God is the God who is over all, and nothing happens, but that God knows about it and is involved and is concerned. And David's experience here is a very interesting one in this respect. And we can see the providences of God in what happened to him in at least two ways. Well, what are they? Well, if I can remind you of the story, first of all, we can see that in the way in which God ordered events here, David was spared the agonizing dilemma, really, of fighting with the enemy against his own people. Now, it wasn't because of any great turning initially in David. It was because of the overruling hand of God. God caused some of the Philistines to become suspicious of him and turned to the king and said, look, this fellow must go. We don't know when he's going to turn on us. He's with us now, but for how long? And in the providences of God, something happened, and the embarrassment that would have been this man of God's experience, he was delivered from it. And let me repeat myself, not because of him, but because of the wonderful workings of God. And then you notice that isn't all the story. But when you come now to chapter 30, this place called Ziklag becomes all important. And again, how interesting that God brought David back into Ziklag at a very important time in the history of the place itself, and of some of the events that had already taken place there. It was an awful situation. It was a very serious one. And David was brought back there just at the right time to look at this whole matter and to seek to deal with it and to handle it in a way that would be honoring to God. Now, can you see it? This is the providence of God. God's ways with his children are so amazing. He works in ways that you wouldn't expect. If you were to sit down with a plain piece of paper or with a graph and try and plot the way of God and be sure that this is the way that he will go, oh, how impossible you and I would find it to be. Because whilst he always works, of course, in keeping with his character and in keeping with his own will and plan and purpose, all the manner in which he causes things to happen are sometimes quite breathtaking and very often astonishing. And not only that, but God's timings are so remarkable and so wonderful. You may be able to look back into experiences in your own life and see that certain things happened for you just at a particular time. And you say, well, it couldn't have worked better. I've heard Christians saying recently, it's good that we were home. We could never have coped with that had we been away. The timings of God. And you can begin to see by that, of course, that God is over all. And he rules over all. And every detailed circumstance is under his sovereign hand. And how amazing that works out on times. Times when it's so simple because we are so slow to learn, we don't see it. But on other times, when it's so remarkable, that we're made to sit up and to lift up our heads and open our eyes, as it were, and see how God is in it. Now, why am I saying that to you? I'm saying that to you to encourage you as well as to challenge you, and my own heart too. You see, he's a God that can be trusted. He's a God that can be relied upon. I will let you down and others will let you down and you likewise to me. The church will never be what the church ought to be. There are so many failings and shortcomings and frailties. Oh, but God remains ever the same. No change, Jehovah knows. He's there. And we can trust him for his providences and for his ways with us. You get disappointments sometimes, don't you? Young people as well as older people. Why? Well, things haven't quite worked out. Why? Ah, God knows. Something is yet going to be in it. There's something there yet. There's something to be gained from it that you and I haven't seen just yet. He can be trusted. The God of history. The God of the generation. Now then, you see that here in this whole account that we have before us. From the first verse on, we find David coming back into this place called Ziklag. And we've already said that the situation there at this time was a very sad one. And it was a sad one because of the activity of these people called the Amalekites. And all the best commentators of the Old Testament in dealing with this history say, you know, these Amalekites, when you look at their history, it tells you something about them. And what it tells you about them basically is this, you know, they picture for us the work of Satan and the work of the enemy in causing havoc and unrest and distress wherever he is allowed to do so. And you can read through the Old Testament and you look for something good coming out of these Amalekites and you look in vain. You can't find it. You turn up every stone where you find them involved to see if there's something underneath the stone. You can say, ah, at least they did this. Nothing at all, other than to oppose and to cause havoc and to hinder the work of God and injure the servants of God, if they can in any way whatsoever, just like the enemy. Now, Satan has never had a kind thought toward you. He's never had the smallest view of you that has in any way been generous. He always views you as someone that he wants to injure, someone that he wants to do down, someone that he wants to trip up and lead you into strange paths and cause you all kind of sorrow and grief if he can. Young people, remember that. When your parents warn you about certain things and about certain places and certain ways, remember that they want your good, because you know the enemy can take you into all kinds of circumstances, and you know he always takes you there, but ultimately he may do you down. Just like these people. Now, I need to prove that, don't I? Can't go on saying things like that without making reference to the Bible. Well, you know, back there in the book of Exodus, in chapter 17, there was an incident going on when Israel was murmuring against Moses and against his leadership. And I think it's in verse 8, in that kind of situation, undercurrents and murmurings and things were not happy and not at peace. You know the kind of thing, it happens sometimes in the life of the church, doesn't it? And you want to draw it out, to see what is wrong, to put it right. Well, it was like that in Israel. And in the midst of that kind of setting and situation, you read a simple phrase like this, in that situation, Amalek came. That's all. But let me say to you, do you know what the best of the writers say about it? Is this, you see, that friction in Israel at that time was just the foothold that Amalek wanted to go into the midst to cause whatever havoc he could. You see, it's like that. That's why I need to be so careful to guard my heart and more careful to guard my tongue and careful with my attitude and manner. Sometimes professing Christians, you can be in their midst and you can almost be embarrassed for their attitude. All our little doors that can be opened and in can come the Amalek. And cause no end of problems. And then, I won't keep you long, another incident there in the book of Exodus, when Israel was receiving water from the rock. You remember the story? And they were so thankful to God that he had provided this for them. And they were rejoicing. Then came Amalek. You see the extremes? Do you know, sometimes when we are rejoicing, it's possible to be off guard. And when we are rejoicing, it's possible that we've dropped the shield of faith, as it were. And the fiery darts can find the object more clearly now. What I'm saying to you is this, the story is seeking to show us about these Amalekites, what enemies they are of God's people, just like Satan is. And you see, whether it's in time of friction, or whether it's time of rejoicing, any time in other words, the Amalekites were always on the lookout to see what problem they could arise and produce in the midst of the camp of God's people. And the enemy of our souls is just like that. So that we can never drop our guard. Young people, you may have seen the one sport that doesn't interest me on television at times, boxing. And you've seen some of them, they've been very overconfident and sometimes they've sort of danced around the ring a little bit and they just drop their guard and they're still safe against their opponent. Well, that might be so, but you can't do that as a Christian facing the enemy. You always need to have your guard. It caused havoc in Ziklag. And David came into that situation. Sometimes we wonder at the providences of God. Well, David could have thought, my, what a situation to come into. And he knew it was a bad situation because he had hardly arrived there. And if you look at verse 6, David came in for much criticism himself. And not only for criticism, even his very life was being threatened in verse 6. He had come back from the Philistines, he'd come back into Ziklag, and the people weren't very kindly disposed towards him. And of course it poses the question, wasn't it? Was David blameworthy for what was happening in Ziklag? If he had stood his ground when he was fearful of Saul, and not become disaffected and gone to the Philistines, the Amalekites may not have had the opportunity to cause the havoc that they did. Was David blameworthy? Because sometimes you've got to stand your ground, haven't you? Even you must do it with grace. But you've got to stand your ground. You just cannot give an inch. There are certain things that you can't do that. They are non-negotiable. Now, if David had not run away on fear of Saul and gone to the Philistines, well, perhaps could things have been different in Ziklag? Was it that was causing these people to raise their displeasure with him now? That he went when he should have stayed? And if he had stayed, well, perhaps it wouldn't have resulted in what had come to pass? And then there's the other situation, of course, that says, well, in fairness to David, it wasn't his fault for what happened in Ziklag. There are some who would want to say that. And so there is this, that we don't need to take either one, we can take both. There are some things that you can't be blamed for. You just weren't there. It's no good blaming you. In fairness, you just weren't around. How could you be made responsible for that? Other times, if you had stood your ground, it might have been better for the life of the church. If you had not compromised, if you had realized that they were non-negotiables, that you're not prepared to give an inch on, that you're not going to budge over, as it would have been possibly better for Ziklag, so it can be better for the church of Jesus Christ. David, in that kind of situation. When I was reading that last week and I thought, well, I've grumbled and I've complained sometimes, and I thought, when problems have arisen, I said, oh, who'd want to be in that kind of situation? As if it's only ever happened to me or to you or to others. My friends, think of this man David here. If ever a man found himself now going back into a situation that was volatile, that could explode or erupt as great as Vesuvius ever had in a moment, it was him here. Such devastation there, such criticism towards him. But you know, what I find interesting is the way that David reacted in that kind of situation. Do you notice? Because that sixth verse, the first part of it, is it's showing that it was a very delicate situation in which he found himself. But you notice what he did. He didn't get up and just go in a huff. Say, well, if that's what they want, they can have it, and I'm just packing my bags and going. Now, sad. Some people have been in situations like that, and that's what they've done. And they haven't helped the situation, they've made it worse. But David didn't do that. Notice what he did at the end of the sixth verse. It's quite interesting. It's a lovely phrase in the midst of this turbulent chapter. He encouraged himself in the Lord. Now, if you look at that in one of the modern translations or in the New King James translation, you might find that the word encouraged is replaced by the word strengthened. Quite right. Both words, it's not a very big Hebrew word, chazak. And it means he encouraged. And encouraging himself means he strengthened himself in the Lord. He found himself in this situation, criticism all around him. The situation itself, so difficult, as we've said, it didn't run. He encouraged himself as the servant of God in that situation. He strengthened himself. He didn't take the off. He didn't whimper and said, oh, they're always on to me. Didn't do that. He encouraged himself. He strengthened himself in his God. And you know the way in which that encouragement and that strengthening of himself in God worked out for him in practice. You see it in the seventh and in the eighth verse. What he did was this. He dedicated himself afresh to serving God. And he sought the face of God how to deal with this very problem. That's the mark of a man of God, isn't it? That's what makes the great distinction between David's reaction to Saul's reaction. Not to be compared. Of course he had disaffected. But he's renewed now. He's back where he once was. He is seeking God again. He's strengthening, he's encouraging himself in God. He's inquiring of God, how am I to deal with this situation? What a wise man. Haven't we said of ourselves and we said of others too, I'm sure, in different times, oh, if only he or she had counted 10, they hadn't been quite so hasty. If they only stopped and thought, if they'd only realized what they were about, they're about the work of God, they're not about themselves. Here's this man David, strengthening himself in God, going back to him, giving himself afresh to God, seeking God, what can I do about this situation? Which is the way that we should be going in this matter? Should I be pursuing these Amalekites to deal with them as the enemies of God's people? You know, he shows himself basically to be a man of spiritual caliber. No wonder God could save him with all his faults. A man after my own heart. God bringing him there. It wasn't an accident. It wasn't something to say, well, I should have had more sense. I wish I hadn't come here. God was taking him there. God to deal with him. And God to deal with the situation. You see, God was over all. All kinds of things were happening, but God hadn't let the reins out of his hand. That's enormously encouraging, isn't it? When you see so much confusion in evangelicalism in our day. When you see such tragedies happening in the life of Christendom, oh, to know that God is still over all, that God still has things in hand, that God is still leading and guiding and directing his servants. He takes them and his children and his church sometimes into situations that are so difficult and delicate. But God taking them just at the right time, to deal with whatever needs to be dealt with. And amazing how the story goes on. To see the way, yes, you pursue them, says God. You go after them. You fight the battles that have to be fought. See, the Christian life is like that, isn't it? If we think it's comfortable and time to sit back and fold our arms and think, well, that's not the Christian life, is it? It's one of battling, isn't it? Battling with yourself and battling with the enemy and battling with the world. You have to battle on, don't you? The year's just begun, but that's what 1995 is going to be like. If we think it's going to become some kind of soft option, I'm sure we're going to be mistaken. We're looking for God to bless us, but we know that we're going to be involved in a battle. We have got to be pursuing the one who is the enemy of our souls, in the whole armor of God, putting each piece on with prayer day by day. We've got to fight the good fight of faith. And another amazing incident happened from verse 11 and onward. And it's this, that in pursuing the enemy, they meet up with a little Egyptian fellow. And he'd been serving with the Amalekites. He'd been with them in their army. But now he had been abandoned quite heartlessly by them. No more use. Do you know, that's typical of the way that Satan uses those that belong to him, you know? No, he uses them to the fullest of his extent and in the end just drop them. You know, wasn't it how it was said of the communist regime in the old days of Stalin in Russia? They valued a person in terms of the person's value to the state. If they were of great value to the state, they were useful. If not, they would abandon them. That's the spirit of Satan himself. Oh, if you're not converted, don't stay another moment under his domain. Seek the grace of God for forgiveness and deliverance from his clutches and from his grip. Because I tell you now that he has no good intention toward you. He'll abandon you at the end, and the wages of sin is death. And you look at verse 15. Amazing. A little man like this. And David begins to talk with him and inquire of him. And he becomes an informant. He's one that God is using now. Out from the very ranks of the Amalekites themselves. And he becomes the one that is able to lead them and to give them what they need. To pursue and to arrive at the place where their enemy is, and eventually to conquer the enemy, to overcome them and to get a great victory over them. Now, whoever would have thought that God would go about conquering the enemy by taking one from their very ranks to do so as a key in leading them to where the enemy was. You see, that's what I mean by God being over all. That's why God can take up we will, whether it's a Cyrus or anywhere else or an Egyptian with the Amalekites and use them in order to gain victory over the enemy of God's people. God in absolute control. Now, in principle, you may have known such an experience. You said, well, I never ever thought it would come about that kind of way. I didn't think that it would happen like that. It happened wonderfully, but I just never thought that it would have gone like that. God, you see. Central. The one we can trust. The one we can look to and hope in. The one that we can call upon and cry to. The God who works all things after the counsel of his will, whose desires and his delights are towards the church, and whose purpose is unflinchingly and unchangingly secure for God's people, and he's going to bring it to pass. The way sometimes in which he'll do it might be quite staggering to you and to me. My friends, the old king was right. We can put our hand into the hand of God and we can go into the future. And we can go into it and knowing it is well. Doesn't mean to say it's going to be easy. Doesn't mean to say the path is going to be straight. Doesn't mean to say that you're not going to have any difficulties or problems or trials, but I tell you that you may be again astonished when you'll see the way in which God will work for you and God will work for us and the channel along which he will work and through whom he will bring his purpose to pass. The God whose timing and whose ways greatly transcend ours. And you know, when you come to the second half or the latter section of the chapter, 21 to 31 particularly, in this matter of Christian service, you can see how our rewards are related to Christian service, which is quite important for us really to understand. Now, in Christian service, there are various tasks that have to be done. And everyone is important. Everyone is important. Some tasks are public and some tasks are less public or private. Some are involved in the front line and others are not so prominent. Now, you look at this, for example. In David's fight against the Amalekites, there were the army that he had with him that did the actual fighting. But you notice at the end of verse 24, we read this interesting little comment, some stayed by the stuff. Now, it's amazing how the authorized version of the Bible is so good in speaking on occasions language so plainly, isn't it? The stuff. We all know what the stuff is, isn't it? Whatever it is, isn't it? The stuff. Some stayed by it. They weren't able to go up into the front line and to do the actual battling there. So they stayed with the stuff. Now, of course, the danger is then that we think that there's something very, very important about those that are fighting in the front line. And, well, these people who stayed with the stuff, well, they're not very important. Could do without them. You can't. You can't. And the principle is to remind us that the church is the body of Christ. And if the body is to function right, every member is to function. The function of some might be very small in comparison to the function of others, but it's still important. There's a principle in the New Testament that causes us to say in a right way to every Christian, my friend, if you're a Christian, you're a very important person. Now, we're afraid to say that sometimes because there's such a view of importance in this world that we think, well, if we say that, people get proud, and we're not saying that. What we are saying is this, as the Apostle Paul could say, you know, the eye just can't say to the foot, we don't need you. And the ear can't say to the hand, can dispense with you. Can't do that. Everyone who is a Christian is important. God has said it so. There is a dignity about a Christian. And in that sense, the Christian must walk tall. And you see, what is important when you think about this matter of service, as we see here, the contrast between David's men and David. They were wrong, he was right. What's important is this in the service that you render. It's the quality of it that counts. It isn't necessarily the amount of it. It's the quality of it. That's why the Old Testament, I'll not render to the Lord that which costs me nothing. The quality starts from the pulpit down to the pew. But well, it's the quality. And rewards are given for quality and for faithfulness, not for success. Now, I think we must grasp that. It's so important. As well as being instructive, it's encouraging. Again, young people, you know better than I do probably, but I know because I hear the news and I see the daily paper. If a football manager isn't successful, he's got to go. All depends upon success. I've often said to my wife, well, thank God it isn't success, or the church would have sent me packing long ago. It's not success. It's quality and faithfulness. If the quality was being exercised by those who stayed with the staff, that counted to God. And whatever you are doing in the life of the church, and I trust you are, it's its quality. Because you notice these people said, well, we don't need to give them any of the spoils. They only stayed with the staff. How wrong they were. Their estimation was very worldly. And it's possible, isn't it, for a Christian and for a church to be worldly in its views about certain things. These people were, and we are no better than them. They could say, well, fancy, all they did was stay by the stuff. They don't deserve anything. But you notice how David puts it in the 24th verse and following. For who will hearken unto you this matter? But as his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarrieth by the staff. They shall part alike. In other words, they shall have the same. What was he doing? He was bringing a Christian perspective to bear upon Christian service. This is how God deals, he says. Doesn't deal with this meager, worldly view that only the man sitting in the top chair gets and the others don't. That's unjust. That's not the way to deal with people. That's the world. David says, the way that God deals with his children, with his church, with his people is this. What are you doing? I've given it to you to do, yes. Are you doing it with all your might? Yes. By the grace of God, is there some mark of quality about it? Yes. Well, come the end of the day, says God. Well done. Well done. Lot sent you down the road. Well done, says God. My friends, that's a challenge and an encouragement, isn't it? Oh, if I give anything to God that is shoddy, or if I'm given to God of the best with my oh-so-limited gifts, God knows, God sees. Well done, he says, a good and a faithful servant. David was so right. They were so wrong. Encouraging yourself in the Lord. Difficult, delicate situation. The way that you and I react to criticism. The way we go on doing the work of God. Ah, but come the end. And as David dealt with these people who stayed by the stuff, do you think God is going to deal with you or I in any different way? I say he isn't. He's large of heart and benevolent. He's great and greatly to be praised. What an interesting account. Why should such a story as that be put into the Bible? Well, in some measure, at least that you and I might draw some of these principles from it. It's not there in vain. It's for our good. Well, may it be that perhaps God will speak some of these things to our heart and help us to cleave to him the more, to trust him and to serve him with all our being, that he might be praised and that many, as a result of it, might be blessed. God grant it, for his name's sake. Amen.